can we make the change we need to save our future?
I investigated multiple theories of change. Like, I looked at past social movements. I spent a lot of time studying how we as collective agents of history have helped foment enormous change, and also how we have failed at it. I think that was another important element, was to look at the revolutions that did not work. Because unlike basically every one of those revolutions, this is something we can't miss on. You know, like, we're not going to get a do-over on this. It's now or never.
That's Stephen Markley. We talk with him about his acclaimed new novel about the climate crisis, The Deluge. Then we talk about what we can do in our own lives to protect our planet from climate disaster. We air some excerpts from interviews with scientist Peter Kalmus, and we talk with climate activist Dar Riley. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We have the science, the technology, and the money to deal with the climate crisis. Solar and wind are the cheapest forms of energy right now. Yes, we can improve on the tech and drive costs even lower. But basically, we know how to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, which scientists tell us can avert the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. And good news, it turns out that once the world reaches net zero, global temperatures will stop going up in as soon as 3 to 5 years, and half of human-made CO2 emissions would drop out of the atmosphere within about 30 years. We can do this. So, what's stopping us? In short, the political will. And the lack of political will in tackling the climate crisis is driven by two other crises: the crisis of economic inequality, which drives the crisis of democracy. That's the key takeaway from Stephen Markley's brilliant and engrossing new novel, The Deluge. The book lays out the different paths that may be taken to changing the political will on climate, the unintended consequences they could lead to, and the twists and turns of political, ecological, and individual fates that intertwine and react with each other. How could a pro-climate mass movement get created? What about eco-sabotage, you know, blowing up a pipeline? Or electoral politics? And how do the fossil fuel interests and the politicians they control try to stop that change? Can they be resisted and overcome? And finally, how can democratic movements counter increasing authoritarianism to save our future? These are all questions Markley explores in gripping prose and vivid characters, like Kate Morris, the charismatic leader of the mass climate movement, Fierce Blue Fire. He brings the near future into sharp focus, making the world we are moving toward vividly real. In addition to The Deluge, Stephen Markley is the author of the novel Ohio and two memoirs, Iceland and Publish This Book. Stephen Markley, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
This book is channeling the very near future, I would say. It just felt so real. It felt like you had a bead on what was going to happen step by step. You really take us down the road we see ahead of us, given the signs that are all around us. I know from listening to Dave Roberts' podcast, Volts, that you began the book in 2010. When did you finish it, just to get a sense of the sweep of changes that might have happened as you wrote the book?
Yeah, so I finished the first draft, actually, in February of 2020, right? So I'd sort of sequestered myself in my apartment for 2 months to get the full first draft done, turned it in, and then immediately, like, global lockdown followed. So you talk about changes, and it was like just in the time after finishing the first draft to when I started editing, you know, some enormous things were happening.
Yeah. Were there changes, though, that happened that made you rethink anything that you had done in the book or made you want to change anything?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like there were so many instances of sort of the real world outpacing the terrifying novel I was writing, right? But, you know, most aggressively, I'd say, was, you know, I had to put The Deluge aside to finish Ohio, which started, you know, I started finishing that, my first novel, Ohio, around 2015. So by the time I picked The Deluge back up in 2017, the terrifying presidential character of my book suddenly didn't seem all that bad. So I had to sort of adjust as I went in terms of just like sort of the acceleration of this crisis, which is not just about the climate, but about our politics, our economy, and our society.
Yeah. And in fact, you really do make the connection, a kind of tripartite connection there between the climate crisis, the crisis of inequality, economic inequality, and also the crisis in our democracy. And I thought that that was really the heart of the book, actually, bringing those three things together. I'd just like to ask you, you know, when did you realize this connection?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole project for me was a process of discovery. And not that like I was naive about any of those situations when I set out, but the project of fiction is to narrativize and dramatize these forces that seem so inchoate and sort of hard to wrap our minds around, right? So the project of the book was largely sort of painting a picture of not only what it feels like now, but what it's going to feel like as we let these three crises accelerate.
Yeah, could you say more about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I was listening to Dave Roberts' podcast, and he had a climate modeler on. And, you know, she was saying basically that we have all these climate models that tell us what's going to happen. This is not being, there's no conspiracy. This is not being hidden from anybody. Like, we know what's coming. But it's very different to know that from sort of a dry climate model than it is to understand, to feel what it's like to live inside of this emergency. And so I think part of the project of the book was to give the reader sort of the emotional and intellectual journey that allows them to understand what's happening and why we should throw everything we have into averting the worst consequences of this.
It's a fascinating book in that not just does it put the reader right in there, but also it seems to have a theory or a number of different theories of change. It's a book that begins in 2013 and it goes to 2039, over about 1,000 pages. Did you have a theory of history or a theory of change that helped you think about the future?
I would say I investigated multiple theories of change, right? Like I looked at past social movements. I spent a lot of time studying how we as collective agents of history have helped foment enormous change and also how we have failed at it. I think that was another important element, was to look at the revolutions that did not work. Because unlike basically every one of those revolutions, this is something we can't miss on. You know, like we're not going to get a do-over on this. There's not a course of history where we can get a chance to do the right thing. It's now or never. And I think that I was trying to bring that sense of urgency, not just to the novel, but to sort of the thinking behind the novel and behind some of the characters within the novel. But I think like what ultimately what I was trying to do was show how these different theories of change could both work, backfire, or create a template for other people to build on. So even when something doesn't work, maybe it leaves residue that creates a path in the future.
Yeah, it does. You know, I felt there were two almost dialectical forces at play in this book, Deluge. And that is, one is kind of the inevitable consequences. You know, I kept on thinking of the word karma, not in the religious or spiritual sense, but in the sense of consequences. These are the consequences that occur when you do certain things. So that was what felt like some of the inevitability of the things that occurred in the book. And on the other hand was the fact that history is always filled with surprises. The future is always filled with surprises. The two opposite forces that really came into interplay. And so I'd like to ask you, outline some of the surprises in the book and the ways that people, you know, are trying to deal with this problem. What were some of the different contrasting ways that you had them respond to the karma that we're experiencing them?
Well, I think there's always an element of, as you very eloquently put it, the randomness and chaos of history. So even if you think you're doing everything right, you know, events have their own momentum and fate has its own ideas about what is going to work and what won't. And so I think like the two most important threads are you have these people with very different sensibilities and very different ideas of how to affect the rapid change we need, right? And, you know, you take a character like Kate Morris, who is throwing her entire being into this project, who is, you know, adaptive and intelligent and constantly trying to find new methods. And then seeing the ways in which she self-sabotages or fails, even though she at the same time is, you know, one of the most compelling characters. And certainly the one who is sort of exemplifying the urgency necessary. And so I think like just making sure you're creating real human beings and bringing with them all their flaws. And in doing that, you can sort of get that randomness, get that chaos that accompanies all the enormous movements of this sort of faux history that I invented.
Right. She's a representative of the, let's say, the non-violent mass movement, or she tries electoral politics as well. It kind of blows up in her face.
Right.
You talk about self-sabotage. That's definitely there in her character. But also there is the huge, the powerful sabotage of the establishment, the puppet masters.
Yes.
And this was one of the most difficult parts for me to deal with because it made me feel like, yeah, these guys, how can we ever win against them?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that? Can one ever win against them, especially given the technological industrial complex of surveillance and repression?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is enormous. And I think certainly we are naive about just how difficult and powerful this is going to be. And certainly when I was on my book tour, I would get questions from the audience filled with a lot of despair, you know, and then just sort of like, how can we possibly do this in the face of so much resistance and such well-coordinated, well-financed resistance, right? And I think that's absolutely fair. And in writing the book, I tried to incorporate just how ferocious that resistance will be. You know, I get frustrated now because you hear a lot of folks talking about like, well, it looks like we've got a handle on the climate crisis. We're only going to go to 2 to 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. And I'm like, that's insane. That's death and suffering for millions, if not billions of people. And it's opening all kinds of Pandora's boxes in our biosphere that could lead to far worse consequences. And so to me, you know, even though there has been progress made in terms of sort of the technological avenue, we are still really far away from finding a way out of this. And I think I did not want to shy away or flinch from the enormous challenges that lie ahead.
Especially since I think a lot of people in the climate movement, myself included, feel that the path forward can only be done through democracy, and our democracy is so threatened.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why these crises are so intimately connected. And, you know, another avenue of thinking that I've found disturbing and unhelpful is sort of, especially in the 2010s, people looking at, you know, how quickly China could move on environmental issues, given the fact that they're, you know, obviously not a democracy. And sort of this being seduced by the idea of authoritarian power as a solution, right? And I think we're getting a very up close and personal view of what a catastrophe that line of thinking could be and will be. And unfortunately, the old Winston Churchill quote about democracy being the worst form of government except for all the others. That is what we have to work with. And I think one of the projects of the deluge is to demonstrate that this, just how frustrating and difficult this is going to be, because we have no other option but to use the institutions that exist. And I'm the first to vociferously say that those institutions are deeply flawed. And that is going to make this project more difficult. But at the same time, it's what we have. And so trying to imagine how we get out of this crisis while still living within the structures that, and systems that we have today.
And yet your own character, Kate Morris, might disagree with you on that, because one of the things that she does is she gets involved with organizing mutual aid networks in low-wealth communities. And there are people who say, we need to go outside of the institutions that exist, not only to fight back on the climate front, but to build the democracy that will allow us to do that more. Mutual aid is one of those. What's your thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that exists very comfortably alongside sort of what I'm talking about, right? You know, we're in a stage of like constant experimentation, and that sort of the effect of mutual aid networks is heartening. But, you know, we need to figure out how to decarbonize all the concrete in our building materials across the planet by 2050. And if there is a mutual aid network working on something like that, like, great. But, you know, it's one of those things where the scale of the challenge is so enormous that in every one of these carbon intensive pieces of our civilization, we need to figure out the best policies to bring rapid change to those systems, right? And so, you know, looking at the problem from the bottom up is absolutely necessary, but the big changes necessary are also going to have to come from the top down. They're going to have to come from federal governments and international institutions. And that is daunting, but I feel absolutely doable.
Well, electoral politics doesn't come in for a whole lot of optimism in this novel, The Deluge.
That's a great point. Yes, that's a great point. But here's what I'll say, though. I think electoral politics gets a bad name because it sucks, right? It's totally frustrating and infuriating all the time. It's soaked in dirty money. It's full of personalities that we all find just awful. And yet it's all we have. And it really has, in the last few years, I think, delivered some victories that we should not be shy about celebrating. And I'm not just talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, but also, you know, I was just listening to my buddy David Roberts' podcast. He's talking to, I think, the Speaker of the House in Minnesota, which just passed a really excellent clean energy bill to decarbonize the state by 2040, right? And so these are the kind of victories that there is no parade where the confetti's falling down, right? It's just constant work. And we have to keep figuring out ways to build on those victories and keep pushing the ball forward. I think there's an element of the deluge that it's trying to get at the difficulty of making this all happen through these really damaged systems we have, but the necessity of it. You know, to some degree, if we change the infrastructure, we change the politics. If we change the politics, we can change what's happening to our democracy. If we can change what's happening to our democracy, we can change what's happening with accelerating inequality. And so finding out the specific levers in our economy, our politics, and our culture that can begin to move the ball on these issues.
It's a tall order, but as you say, absolutely necessary. So, Stephen Markley, there's a whole other thread that you explore in terms of the climate movement in this novel, The Deluge, and that is the one of direct violent action. Now, at first, and mostly, it's focused on the destruction of property. Monkey wrenching is the term.
Yeah.
But it does inevitably well, perhaps inevitably go down the road of violence against people as well. Talk a little bit about how you developed that thread and what your conclusions were that you came to.
Yeah, well before Andreas Malm wrote How to Blow Up a Pipeline, you know, I just, you look at this problem and you're kind of baffled that that kind of movement hasn't erupted in a more widespread way. Like you look at what's happening and the moral case for direct action is obviously there, right? And so I spent a lot of time exploring not only the past sort of environmental groups that have dealt with that, but also like just how that's worked sort of in various social movements in contemporary history, right? I think even if there is a moral case for something, one of the things that I decided, and I think a lot of characters in the book have decided, is that just because you want to do something doesn't mean you're doing the most effective thing, right? I think that is a lesson that is really hard to impart because none of us really know what's going to work, right? This is an absolutely unprecedented situation. And yet, if you're taking action that is not only not effective, but perhaps, you know, damaging the work of building a mass movement, then, you know, we have a problem. And I think what the book tries to do is show the complexity of what happens when you create an atmosphere where radical action and violence are suddenly allowable. And so, you know, it's not as if those characters in the book come up with no victory. Right? Like you blow up a coal plant and those carbon emissions are not going to be belching into the atmosphere anymore, right? But it's also a question of what do you unleash afterwards? And I think that those were some of the forces I was playing with. And I think, you know, if people read the book, they will sort of understand the dangers inherent in that path.
Yeah, I think that was there was a lot of wisdom in revealing that, and there even has been some, you know, I don't know if it's from research or just thought on the topic that says that, you know, the most powerful movements are those that are mass nonviolent movements.
Yes, yes.
On the other hand, you are outlining an America in which the surveillance state, fascism, basically, or authoritarianism, whatever you want to call it, is married into a juggernaut that makes it very, very difficult to do anything. I mean, nonviolent mass movement doesn't work if you're all going to just be thrown into jail.
Yeah.
In black sites, you know, which is pretty much what happens in the book. So,
right. But I'd also say that, you know, authoritarianism and repressive systems have their own consequences. And even though that terror can rain down for decades, generations, whatever it might be, it eventually spills over into resistance. And, you know, I think one of the difficulties of telling people, like, you know, we have to do this patient work is that the crisis is in their lives, right? The crisis is within their families, their homes, their communities. And yet at the same time, one of the sort of Achilles heels of the climate movement has been its inability to build a mass movement that involves working class people, that involves people at different strata of society, and that binds us together in this shared goal. And I think that's changing, but at the same time, it's one of the reasons why mass movements are effective, because they're drawing in each and every part of society.
Yes, and I have seen real change. I mean, I've been doing, as my listeners know, I've been involved with climate issues. Really, in 2004, I had an epiphany that we could be the last generation of humans on Earth.
Yeah.
And that's when I began to work on the issue. And I've seen a real change recently with many more coalitions building between labor and environmentalists, and real leadership that is being also taken by communities of color who have typically not been part of this, but they're really taking leadership in the climate movement. I see some hope in that. Is that something that you explored also in your own thinking?
Absolutely. And I think the long overdue marriage of environmental justice concerns with the climate movement has been, you know, one of these quiet game changers, especially when it came to passing the Inflation Reduction Act. And this is something I've been going around saying at my book signings, which is that when you look at the infrastructure that we need to build, what we have to do to transition the economy into zero carbon energy, it is going to require so much labor. Just like one example Bill McKibben's always throwing out is the U.S. is going to need 1 million more electricians over the next decade, which is really staggering. Now, you know, if those electricians are union electricians, that's not just jobs, a boost to the economy, the transition to renewable energy. That's also political power. And I think that's something that the movement has to embrace and you know, really focus on is getting that union labor involved in the political realm, not just to decarbonize, but also to begin to, you know, attack sort of the social element of this the crisis of inequality that sort of keeps our politics so skewed.
And also, you know, it's interesting, rural America has really been left out of the whole climate environmental coalition.
I could not agree more, yes.
And there's really no good reason for that, because agriculture and regenerative agriculture is going to be a key part of being able to tackle the climate crisis. Just simply getting people to do cover crops.
Absolutely. And I'm from Ohio, and I keep saying, like, the climate movement has to win Ohio, not just to win its Senate seats and its congressional districts, but to sort of win the backing of those rural communities. I mean, right now, you know, Ohio is insane. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with the scandal, your listeners are, but the first energy scandal, there's a guy being tried right now, you know, basically for racketeering, for taking bribes from a utility in order to keep, like, dinosaur coal plants online, right? Like, it's just like a level of gross corruption that you just, like, can't believe when you read about it. But this is all, like, because of our carbon economy, because of this bizarre situation that we find ourselves in. And once Ohio is running itself off of wind, solar, geothermal, whatever it might be, those politics are going to change. And with it is going to come, I think, a real opening towards some of the other issues that we're all concerned with. So again, like, changing the infrastructure is the goal, because it will change the politics. Changing the politics will change everything else.
Yeah, and I think the politics is the real issue here, because it is so deeply corrupted. I mean, even, you know, the Democrats have promised a lot and delivered very little. And that seems to be their modus operandi. And even those voices in the Democratic Party who are clearest on this, especially some of the younger progressives, are being fought tooth and nail by their own Democratic leadership. So what will change the politics, do you think?
Again, it's changing the infrastructure, changing, you know, So for instance, building electric, like the methane gas industry is fighting building electrification with everything it has inside of it. Like it views building electrification as a mortal threat to its business model, which it is. Okay. Like, that's absolutely correct. And so right now the methane gas industry can afford to go around lining the pockets of politicians and putting out propaganda and using ratepayer money to facilitate all this, you know, BS. But as their revenue begins to dry up, as buildings are electrified, as they are in places like California, New York State, and elsewhere that have passed really sort of stringent new climate laws, that's going to change the situation. So it sounds too slow, because it is. And yet at the same time, this is like, these are tools, you know, we are reaching into the tool bag right now, trying to find anything that works. And the things that have worked are crushing demand for fossil fuels by electrifying everything. And I think there's a lot of momentum behind that. And in the next decade, we're going to be able to see, you know, some of this work come to fruition.
Well, from your mouth to God's ear, Stephen Markley, I totally hope that will happen. I mean, I'm engaged in the legislative fight in New York State to get our part of the what's called the Renewable Heat Now Coalition, which is pushing to get a number of different laws passed, including the Electrify New Buildings Act. And, you know, we just find at every turn that fine words are not followed up with effective action on the part of legislators. Yeah. And you know, so that it's always delay and deny. It feels to me that we need to do both building a mass movement at the same time, however that happens, at the same time as pushing on the halls of our legislators.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. And I think for me, this is where art comes in. You know, I definitely had this thinking during my 10 years of reading the book and watching this crisis grow more dire and grow more frightening, which is that is this really how I should be spending my time? If this is something I care about as much as I think I do, and I'm as passionate about it as I think I am, like, should I be, you know, whatever, gluing myself to paintings or whatever it might be? Like, what can I do that feels more urgent than this? And yet, you know, what I've decided is that there's an element of this where we just need to understand what's happening better. And so, you know, we use art to communicate the urgency of these things. And yeah, I just think everybody in this country and on this planet has a small bit of agency and lowering our shoulders and doing what we can, trying new things, always switching tactics and being inventive. It's what we have to do. And I like to tell people, you know, look, like, a crisis is also an opportunity. And in the book, there's a character talks about how the climate crisis is the keyhole through which we build a more just, equitable, and prosperous world. And I think that's something we lose sight of sometimes, is that, you know, the changes we're going to make aren't just going to have benefits for, you know, keeping civilization alive, but for public health and for the distribution of wealth and power and resources. And again, just looking at this moment, as scary as it is, as an opportunity.
You say that so eloquently. I must tell you, that is really what keeps me going, is the sense that this is not just, you know, it's not just a tragedy in the making. It is an opportunity to really create another world. And I think you, when you talk about art, I have not seen a book. Although, I mean, I think Ministry of the Future was another one that really talked a lot about this. But I think The Deluge, more than any other book that I've read about the climate crisis as it is in reality, describes and puts the reader right there to really understand what's going on. I think your book is making a huge impact. And it's been such a privilege to talk with you about it, Stephen Markley.
Yeah, thank you. It's such an intelligent and wonderful conversation. I'm going to have to start listening to your podcast now. This has been great.
Oh, thank you. So the book is The Deluge, and I highly recommend it to my listeners. Thank you so much, Stephen Markley, for talking with us about it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Stephen Markley. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Deluge. Next up, what we can do in our own lives to help solve the climate crisis. Stay tuned after the break. Paul McCartney, Despite Repeated Warnings. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Earth Day happens this week, a time for people to celebrate our beautiful planetary home and honor it by thinking of ways we can protect it. We've taken two excerpts from past episodes that help us do just that. First, a clip from our 2017 interview with atmospheric scientist Peter Kalmus. Last year, he was arrested for locking himself onto an entrance to the J.P. Morgan Chase building in downtown L.A. That bank is the number one funder of fossil fuel projects around the world. But you don't have to lock yourself to a bank door in order to help out with the climate crisis. A few years before his arrest, Kalmus wrote a book about how to make personal choices to help protect the climate, Being the Change, Live Well, and Spark a Climate Revolution. It's not just about decreasing your own carbon footprint, but also motivating other people to do the same. Let's take a listen. You talk about going beyond fear and guilt, environmentalism. So how do you motivate people?
That's a great question. You know, one of the hardest things to do is to persuade someone else to change in some way. Certainly, before I started reducing my own use of fossil fuels, I felt like, you know, I got the seriousness of global warming, and I think it's far more serious than the average person thinks, speaking as sort of a citizen and as an atmospheric scientist with a front row seat to the changes that are happening to the Earth right now that we're causing. It's very, very serious. But before I started to change, you know, I think when I told people, oh, it's serious, we got to stop burning fossil fuel, they didn't take me very seriously. You know, I think they thought that I was kind of preaching at them. It probably made them feel a little bit guilty. So when I started reducing my own fossil fuel use, you know, all I did was I would do it. And I'd say, hey, I tried this thing and it, you know, made me happier. I really enjoy biking instead of driving. You know, gardening is great. And I just do this stuff. And then people kind of see me and they see me doing something with a smile. And they're like, oh, he's really enjoying that. And then I think it plants the seed in their mind. And then they start doing, you know, similar. And then, of course, you know, I don't hide what I'm doing. I write about it. I write for a magazine called Yes Magazine. You know, I wrote this book in an attempt to help other people imagine a life with far less fossil fuel, to make that seem less alien to them and to help shift the culture in that way. And I think we have to explore this together as communities. Everyone's going to come at this with a slightly different point of view, and they're going to experiment in slightly different ways, and we can learn from each other and support each other.
You say the path is through head, hands, and heart. What do you mean by that?
Right. So my kind of first response to global warming was intellectual. So I'm a scientist. I was trained as a physicist. And, you know, when I started realizing that this was a serious thing, this was in 2006, when I finally realized it, and kind of having my first child was a huge catalyst for this, because I suddenly was like, you know, what kind of world are they going to have? And it kind of woke me up. My response was to read scientific papers. And after many papers and like a year of kind of learning about it, I was like, you know, this is really serious. This is real. You know, I had some kind of fundamental understanding of the science. And I went around, you know, shaking people by the lapels, like I said, and saying, hey, look, here's the science. We have to change. And that got me nowhere. So the hands means actually doing stuff. So that was kind of getting involved, looking at my own life, you know, rolling up my sleeves, saying, all right, here's where my emissions are coming from. You know, 75% from flying. Second biggest source of emissions was from food, from a meat diet. Then, you know, how can I stop driving so much? So I looked at my life and said, here's where it's coming from. Now, how can I get that out of my life? Because I don't like burning it anymore. The harm fossil fuels is causing was very clear to me. And I don't want to harm others. That's like a fundamental principle in my life. And that's where the heart kind of comes in. So the changes that I'm making are easy for me to sustain and easy for me to keep exploring this and easy for me to write about, because everything I do is coming out of love. So, you know, when I had my kids, it just completely revolutionized how I thought about myself and other people and how I felt about love. You know, having kids is it's like a titanic event in someone's life. And as I kind of integrated that with my understanding of global warming, I started thinking about other people's kids too, and kids that weren't born yet, and other animals on this planet that are going extinct and that don't have a voice. So it was like this huge wave of love that, for the entire biosphere, and like a deep sense of humility that I exist at all, you know, that the biosphere gives me everything that I need to survive, the air that I'm breathing right now, clean water to drink, good food, you know, an avocado tree in my backyard, a tree that makes avocados. And what could be more miraculous than that? So that's the heart. And I think all three of them, for me at least, for my path, were important, and they kind of support each other.
So let's get down to some brass tacks here. What are some ways that people can begin?
You know, it's hard for me to kind of give a prescription to someone else, right? So the point of view of my book is to say, here's what I did. You know, and I hope that gives other people ideas, and I hope that it helps inspire them to kind of explore things on their own. You know, I think that probably pretty universally, though, a good place to start is to actually understand where your emissions are coming from. So, I mean, there's this question that's hanging out there, I think, that maybe we need to address, which is, why is there any point in an individual reducing his or her emissions at all? So a lot of environmentalists say that it's a mistake to focus on individual change, because we need change at the systems level. This is urgent, and individual change is not going to solve the problem. It's not going to happen quickly enough. And frankly, they're basically right. But my answer to them is, it's not an either or thing. It's an all of the above thing. And furthermore, I think maybe part of why there hasn't been a lot of progress at the systems level, at least in my opinion, on climate action, is maybe because there haven't been that many individuals willing to change. There haven't been a lot of leaders on climate, activist leaders, scientist leaders, who say, this is important enough that, you know, I'm going to dramatically reduce my own emissions. If a climate leader isn't reducing his or her own emissions and is in fact emitting more than the average American, what kind of a message does that send? You know, that sends a message that this isn't really that important. Or maybe it sends a message that it's still socially acceptable to burn fossil fuels. It says, you know, even if someone who cares about it this much isn't reducing, that kind of implies that it's essentially impossible to reduce, right? And that's kind of a demoralizing message. So I think it's very important to tell this story, that it's quite possible to reduce, it's not that hard, and that there's a lot of benefits to your life in addition to not emitting that much fossil fuel, you know, like riding a bike. It's super fun. When I started riding my bike, it was because I didn't want to emit the CO2 from burning that gasoline. But what I found was, it was super fun, and it got me healthier, and I really enjoy it. And I would keep riding my bike as much as I do now, even if there was no global warming, just because it's such a wonderful part of my life. You know, you get all of these extra benefits, and then you're telling the story that it is possible to reduce. Now, how can other people start doing this? I think it's important for them to find ways to live outside of the status quo fossil fueled system that they really enjoy. So they could try traveling more slowly, you know, traveling by train. They could try becoming vegetarian. They can try getting more involved with their community. They can write, they can do art, you know, whatever someone's talents or interests lie, there's some way to connect that to helping shift the culture on global warming. And once we start shifting this culture, then I think the space gets opened up for systems level change and for policy level change, because as the culture shifts, people are going to demand that their elected leaders do something about global warming. And those elected leaders are going to fear that they'll lose their positions if they don't. So the cultural shift translates to a shift at the voting booth, which translates to a shift in the way policies get crafted. So I think that there's a very important connection between individual level change and systems level change, which is currently underappreciated in the environmental movement.
I think that's a terrific point. My mother went through World War II, so she was subject to all the kinds of energy savings that were really pushed by the government. It was a cultural shift. When I grew up, we always had to turn off the lights. It was just, you know, if you weren't using the light, you turn it off.
Yeah, that's a cultural shift, yeah. Yeah, I tell my kids, you know, you wouldn't leave the water running in the bathroom and walk out. Well, why would you leave the light running? Why would you leave the electricity running? Right. And it's a shift towards viewing all of these resources that we have. Clean water is precious. Electricity is so useful, right? It's allowing us to have this conversation. And fortunately, there's a way to, it's becoming easier and easier to generate electricity without using fossil fuels. But, you know, I think if we stop taking all of the stuff we take for granted, you know, food's a big one for me. I think that gratitude toward food is a major way to change the mindset, and it's a way to feel humility. It's a way to remind us that we're integrated into the web of life. And I feel like our society has lost, really to a large extent, gratitude for food, and we basically take it for granted. So personally, my own life has become greatly enriched by having more gratitude for these things. I actually would go so far as to say that gratitude is a necessary ingredient to happiness. It's very hard, I think, at least for me, to be happy if I'm taking everything for granted, right? Because we're surrounded by miracles. Just the fact that we're here at all and having this conversation, quite frankly, it's a kind of miracle. And how sad is it that when we have all of these miracles in our lives, we can still feel, you know, unhappy and depressed and bored, right? And that's a function, I think, of taking things for granted. And it's just a slight shift, you know, a slight shift sideways in how you view the world. And, you know, you can see your neighbors as kind of this amazing resource, or you can see them as sort of annoying, I guess. And
yeah, and actually, Peter Kalmus, you do talk about not just doing this on the individual level, nor doing it on the whole system-wide level, but on the community level as well, in your book, Being the Change. So talk a little bit about community networks. What do you mean by that?
You know, it's very hard for a normal person like me to kind of make direct changes, you know, at the national level or at the international level. But, you know, it's possible for me to change myself, and it's possible for me to have some effect at the community level. And you know, there's a lot going on in anyone's community, and it's just a question of tapping into it.
Peter Kalmus talking with us in 2017 about his book, Being the Change. As we heard, one way to spread the word on climate is to connect with your neighbors. That's what a new initiative aims to help anybody do. It's called Carbon Crew, and it was co-founded by my guest from early January of this year, Dar Riley. Carbon Crew was an outgrowth of her activism with a global climate movement called Drawdown, founded by Paul Hawken. Drawdown talks about 100 solutions to the climate crisis that people and communities can take on their own. And Carbon Crew is designed to make that easy for small groups of friends and neighbors to do. Members of Carbon Crew meet for 5 sessions to develop their own personal carbon reduction plan. Things like decreasing food waste, which Dar Riley told me to my surprise, is one of the most powerful ways you can lower your carbon emissions. Also, transportation, energy, and more. Let's hear more about Carbon Crew from Dar Riley. Tell us about this project. Tell us, you know, it's based on a book. Tell us about the book and the movie. And then we'll go into the details of actually how the Carbon Crew project works.
Okay, great. Well, behind the scenes, there is this fellow in Australia, Damon Gomeau. And he had not been very environmental. He was an extremely well-known actor and created an amazing movie, that sugar film, I think is what it's called down there. But he took his family to Brazil and was in the rainforest, and all of a sudden his perception of what was happening in the world and the degradation of the environment just grew in him, and overnight he became an environmentalist. And as he searched around the world for solutions, he bumped into Paul Hawken and the Drawdown Priority Project. He put together this movie that you're mentioning, 2040, and he also wrote a book called The 2040 Handbook. And as we were going through all that material and saw the value of it, some of the things that were mentioned in that book is that change happens when the early adopters are motivated and talk about it. That's the work of Catherine Hayhoe, the scientist from Texas, who says that the most important thing we can do for climate change is talk about it. So we also learned that what Bernie Sanders did in his campaign was that people wanted to get together in person, and they have coffee clutches. And then what their task was, or what they wanted to do, was go out and replicate that and have their own coffee clutch. And we also learned the power of the individual, that in major scientific studies in the United States and in Europe, they understand that, in fact, 2/3 of all emissions are determined by choices that we make at the household level. So this is really incredible, and bringing that together with Paul Hawkins' positivity, we realized that if we could bring groups of people together and we could make our own plans together, that we would be empowered. We'd already been working in Drawdown East End with creating climate action plans. And this notion was that we really needed personal climate action plans, PCAPs. And some of us who were reading the book together, the 2040 Handbook, said, hey, this would be a perfect book club on a mission kind of way, that we could take these different topics 1 week at a time and create our entirely own personalized climate action plans, with, of course, the aim to reduce our overall carbon footprint by 50%. So we started getting together and creating iterations of this, you might call it a course. It's hosted by anyone who would like to host it. What we do is we created a curriculum and we put that on the web. So it's open sourced. Anybody can go there and they can find this curriculum for the 5 sessions following the book, 2040 Handbook. And then we supply them with other kinds of materials that augment what's in the book. So if we're working on fashion, we're suggesting the movie, The True Cost. Amazing film, by the way. So there are other things one can do in between times. We also show some short clips during the hour and 20-minute sessions that we have. And we tell each other about what we're thinking of doing, about what our climate action plan is. So it's extremely non-judgmental. It's an opportunity to take each of our own next steps. So there's no judgment. There's crews with people who've never hardly done a thing before, and crew with the mayor of Hastings-on-Hudson, who's done everything and ran for mayorship 100% on a green campaign. And you've been at a cruise, so you know, but my experience being in a lot of crews and being a host is that people energize one another. It's this notion we inspire one another when we come together in a group and when we share what we're up to. And when we come together, let's call ourselves, because we're ready to take our next step in the climate realm, let's call ourselves early adopters. When we talk about it, then the early majority is changed and they are ready to come on board too. So this is this wave of ripple effect.
The title of the project is Carbon Crew, but it's C.R.E.W. What does that stand for?
Carbon Reduction for Earth Well-Being. So thanks for asking. So our website is carboncrewproject.org.
carboncrewproject.org. We will link to that at our website, writersvoice.net. And it is a brilliant name. So now let's get down to the nitty-gritty. A typical carbon crew project, well, you go through different stages. What are some of the different things that you tackle in the home? I mean, food waste, we know that's going to be one of them. What are some of the other topics that each session of the crew is addressing?
Well, a great question. So we do use the book as our guide and go through it. So each week we're reading either one or two chapters. So for example, we meet together first and go over the whole concept and why we're doing what we're doing. And then the first one that we address is energy and transportation. So we look at our transportation needs, and some of us who live out here in, I live in the middle of the woods, 3 miles from town. So it's not, there's not public transportation for me. What kind of changes can I make? And does an electric car make sense for me to purchase over the next 5 years? Everybody's got their own different things that they can do in transportation. In energy, the first thing that we learn is if we can create a green energy supply for our house, then the number one thing we want to do is to electrify our houses. So, for example, we haven't been able to put solar collectors on our house because we live in the middle of the woods, but we can through PSEG, which is our supplier of electricity. We can purchase from another company through them wind power. So my husband and I pay a bit of a premium, and we are able to do that. Everyone is not. And so we are pulling that much wind energy into the system that we use. So we know it's not direct, but you get the gist. And so I've had all sorts of gas burners. Well, now I've got an electric kettle, and now I've got an electric air fryer, and now I've got an electric, what do you call those pressure cookers?
Oh, yeah, like an Instapot.
So I've shifted, and now I've also got a sample, one of those magnetic heaters.
You mean induction cooktop?
I've got that, and so I've switched all those things. The one thing that we need to continue to work on, we've had somebody in about a heat pump because we still have fossil fuel powered hot water. That's the last thing that we need to get rid of, and we're looking into heat pumps so we can do that. So that is in the first week. And what we do is co-host when we're hosting. We tell other people in an email what we've done, so it couldn't be possibly an inspiration for them. They don't have to look at that because we don't want to overwhelm them. But sometimes it helps to see what other people have been up to make our plans. And we also read the other people in the group's plans, so that if you're a host and you've already done something, you can say, hey, you're changing your whatever. Here's a great way that I did it, or, you know, other information.
And I want to point out, by the way, if you there are now since yesterday, since Monday, there are federal credits, tax credits, and for low and moderate income, direct upfront payments to buy things like induction cooktops and induction stoves, heat pump water heaters, solar energy,
yeah,
and heat pumps to heat and cool your home. So it's a really exciting time to be in a carbon crew because there's so much more support for it now. Dar Riley, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about Carbon Crew Project. We will link to it. There are loads of resources on your website.
Thank you so much, Francesca. I totally enjoyed it.
Since that interview that we aired in January, Carbon Crew has upgraded its program. It's now a turnkey process to set up and host a Carbon Crew with scripts, handouts, worksheets, and resources. So go to carboncrewproject.org to learn more. We'll also post the link at writersvoice.net. And happy Earth Day! That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.